So we're going to continue our study of Sefer Shmuel Beis, and we're up to Perek Chaf, chapter 20, Pasuk Tazayin, verse 16, and the rebellion of Sheva ben Bichri is going, and David had dispatched first Amasa, who is his new commander, who had come over from the rebellion of Avshalom. And then Yoav decided to take matters into his own hands. Yoav killed Amasa, and now Yoav is basically leading the troops. And they've identified that Sheva ben Bichri is holed up in a city and is there. The city's called Avel Beis Macha. And they basically have the city totally surrounded. They're beginning to dismantle the wall. And it would give the appearance that they are ready to do whatever it takes to take down that Yoav and his men are ready to do whatever it takes to take down Sheva ben Bichri and put an end to this rebellion. Again, a rebellion coming off the heels of a previous rebellion. And at this point, you could almost say from a big picture perspective, it's getting out of hand that Yoav acting on behalf of David really has to squash any rebellion in order to have a stable government. It can't just be every time someone's upset, oh, rebellion. Throughout world history, we know sometimes maybe governments or things that work that way, and there's no stability. So that's what's happening outside the city. Pasuk Tes Zayin brings us inside the city. Vatikra Isha Chachama Min Ha'ir. There was a wise woman, and she called out from the city. She called out to the army that's on the outside of the city. Shimu, Shimu. Listen, listen, a double language to show emphasis. Imru na el Yoav. Now go and tell Yoav, Kirav adhena, to come here, v'adabra elach, and I will speak to you. So whether she is actually calling out or she's having it called out on her behalf, and she's calling to invite Yoav to talk, perhaps what we would imagine to talk, to negotiate what's going on here. And she's asking Imri na el Yoav. She doesn't assume that the soldiers right by the wall of this city, the Yoav's men who are right by the wall, beginning to dismantle the wall, that Yoav's not necessarily on the front line. And so she's saying, tell Yoav that he should come close so that I can have a dialogue with him. Now, it's not the first time we have an unidentified Isha Chachama. And so it's natural for the commentaries, the Midrashim, to try to identify this woman. The only suggestion that I've seen is a really wild one. It's really wild because you do simple, a little bit math. The Medrash, Radak quotes from the Medrash Shmuel that this woman was Serach Bas Asher. Serach, the daughter of Asher. We already know her to be a wise woman. We know that she was the one chosen to break the news to Yaakov that Yosef was still alive. Famous Medrash that talks about that whole scenario in Parshas Vayigash. But there she was the daughter of Asher talking to her grandfather. And in the merit for that, so it's understood that she was blessed with long life. And so we have in the Psukim, she's mentioned both those who went down to Mitzrayim and those who came out of Mitzrayim. So while saying that it's the same Serach Bas Asher who went down to Mitzrayim and came out of Mitzrayim, so she has to be at least 210 years old and a little bit more. Which, again, for biblical terms, if you know, it's not, you're playing the miracle card a little bit, but she was blessed by Yaakov to have long life. To say that she's still alive now, so the Abarbanel does the counting, she'd be about 684 years old, which is, again, if you're gonna play the miracle card, then anything happened in the earliest times, right? Pre-flood, it was very normal for people to live very long. Noach, who's the bridge between pre-flood and post-flood, lived till he was 900 years old. So somehow, some way, we could be tapping into that.
What did they pick her, though? I mean, it could be anybody. It's anonymous. It's Isha. Why pick her?
So,
Must be based on something.
right, it's that she was blessed with long life, and the Medrash, I'm not sure. So if you don't want to take the Midrashic approach, then she's just Isha Chachamah. Why she is unidentified, we don't know. It might not necessarily, meaning what in the end, what she does is in the end, she plays a role in saving the city. And so her action is maybe what is highlighted. Probably what you'd have to do is you probably have to try to do some type of study of all the times that we have Isha Chachamah and see like why exactly is there no identification? Why is it generic? Is it I don't know. Is this like some type of tznius? Is it some type of modest? Would she not want to be like you end up? It's much. I think the answers are much harder to find than the question of who is she?
But usually the men are identified.
Correct. So is that like a pattern that's always? Is that, and then why is that? Which I imagine some people ask, and some people, I imagine there's some answers, or at least maybe commonalities where you could see it's an actual pattern, not just random here and there, but maybe it actually runs through Tanakh. So Pasuk Yud Zayin, Vayikra Avela. So Yoav agrees and he comes close towards her. Vatomer Isha, and the woman says, Ha'ata Yoav, are you Yoav? Vayomer ani, he says, I am. Now she could just be saying, I asked to speak to Yoav. I've never met Yoav before. And so she's just saying, are you actually Yoav? The understanding is that it might be a little bit accusing. Are you really Yoav? Could you really be Yoav? Would Yoav do what you're currently doing? Because it appears that you're attacking the whole city to take one person. You're looking for one person and you're attacking the whole city. And as she's going to explain in the Psukim, you never gave options to the city. You never gave the city the chance to surrender. So Rashi highlights. We'll see a pasuk in Perek Chaf Gimel. There's a pasuk talking about those who worked for David and those who are part of David's government, and it talks about someone who is very wise. And one of the answers or one of the explanations is that's a reference to Yoav. So if Yoav is so wise and goes according to the ways of the Torah, how could you really be Yoav? The Torah before you annihilate a city, even if they're maybe deserving to be captured. You're supposed to ask if they're willing to surrender, if they're willing to leave, if they're willing to, in this case, if they're willing to give up Shiva ben Bichri. There was no dialogue. It was right to action. And while we know Yoav to be, this military warrior, he doesn't seem to be someone who acts without thinking. He seems to be Mr. Super planned out. And every time he assassinates someone, it's because, he thinks it's crucially important and he's got it all planned out. He's hiding weapons. He knows how to get. He's not dumb. He's not. So she's saying you're kind of acting without thinking. Could it be you, Yoav? But
So
Yom,
can I just interrupt?
yeah.
So it wasn't he didn't have a band of followers in the city. Shimei ben
Well, we
Bichri.
don't. Meaning Yoav doesn't know.
So it wasn't his city per se.
It wasn't his city per se. It
That's
was
what
a
I mean.
Benjaminite city. It was a city
Right.
of people from his tribe.
Right.
But the it was never
So
the
Yoav
research
didn't
wasn't done.
check it out.
Right.
Okay.
That seems and that seems to be and when you see the end of the story is that well let's see how it develops, right? So Vatomer Isha, I'll tell you, Vayomer Ani, he says yes. Vatomer Lo, she says to him, Shema Divrei Amasecha, listen to the words of your maidservant, talking about herself. So again, we've seen that is when you want to make a convincing speech, you want to show your deference to the person you're speaking. So we've seen people call themselves Avadecha, Amasecha, right? You recall, right? one of the Isha Chachamot, who we did know her name, Abigail, when she was trying to give her persuasive speech to David not to destroy her husband Nabal in the household and spill, you know, virtually innocent blood, she began speaking to David in such humbling terms that that's at least an entrance way, right? If you're trying to give a persuasive speech and you speak down to the person, all of a sudden we all know it's natural. We put up our defenses, right? But if someone is nice to you as they're persuading you, you know, it's like it's the salesman giving you the can of Coke in the beginning of the deal. He's got you a little bit. So she says, Shema divrei amasecha, your maidservant, vayomer, and he said, Shomea anochi, I'm listening to that which you want to say. Vatomer leimor pasuk yudches, she says, saying as follows, Daber yedabru barishona leimor, your men, or you should have spoken, it's plural, Daber yedabru, they should have spoken barishona originally, before they're starting to dismantle the walls, Lamor saying, Sha'ol yisha'alu be'evel v'chein heisamu. They should have asked of Evel. Evel is the name of the town. V'chein heisamu. So the word heisamu comes from the language of Tam. We just, last week, and Parshas told us, right? Yaakov is described as an ish Tam. Tam is peaceful, is quiet, is... And so v'chein heisamu, it's a saying that we would have been peaceful, that the people of Avel, would have made peace with you. Had you spoken to us, we definitely would have made peace with you. That's the type of people we are. That's what she's saying. Now, we never know for sure if this is true or not, or if this is just part of her... Right, we don't know who she is. That's what we said before. She doesn't seem necessarily. She's not necessarily acting with the permission or with the backing of the people of the city. She may very well just be a really wise woman who sees a terrible situation happening, and she comes almost out of nowhere, not as a city representative. And so she may be serious. She may not. She may be just trying to use. She's an Isha Chachama. She may be trying to use a tool to buy time, because if she can get Yoav to stop what he's doing, then maybe she can turn to her crew, to the inhabitants of the city, and say, listen, something's about to happen. I've pressed pause. Can we try to deal with this? And so it doesn't matter if this really was the case or not, or if this whole thing is part of her wisdom. So she says, had you asked us that, which you didn't. And so kind of in a, maybe you would say polite way, she's putting a little bit of the blame how this situation has snowballed into, there's a city in Israel that's about to be destroyed, onto Yoav. Mm-hmm. When really, who's the, right? The bad guy is really Sheva ben Bichri. But now Yoav is a little complicit in terms of doing bad. So that'll cause Yoav to pause. And she says, continues in Pasuk Yutes, Anochi Shilumei Emunei Yisrael. I am one of those who are faithful and loyal people of Israel. Ata Mevakish, you desire, you are searching to do Lahamis, to kill. Ear the aim be Yisrael. I forgot to do a check in Tanakh. Is this the first time, and how many times? This is a catchphrase. An ir ve'em v'Yisrael, a city and a mother in Israel. Ir ve'em v'Yisrael is used colloquially, at least, you know, definitely in the world of yeshivas, to talk about like a nice Jewish town, right? If you talk about a nice Jewish town in Europe before it was destroyed, you would call it, you know, ir ve'em v'Yisrael. It's like, it's always been a city. The phrase Ein B'Yisrael, mother in Israel, so it may refer to the fact that sometimes you have a city and you call the villages around the city, the small villages that surround the city, you refer to them as banos, children, because they all are dependent on the economy of the bigger city. And it's almost like a mother-child relationship. The Art Scroll notes on the bottom, and I checked it out, at least on Wikipedia, because the translation of Ir Ve'Em B'Yisrael, the translation Art Scroll writes on the translation side is metropolis. You have that?
Mm-hmm. What a city and a mother.
Yeah. A city and a motherness. So they went very literal. Metropolis, though, is also literal. Metropolis is Greek. Greek for mother city. I don't know how to say mother in Greek. I didn't look that part up. But on at least the word metropolis means mother city. Again, does it come from the Bible? These are all, I didn't go that far in my research. But metropolis, large city, aim is that might be the terminology. It may be a way to, it may be a praise of the city that this is such a special place. Again, we haven't heard much about it, but so you're willing to kill an entire city and a very large city, an important city. Lama sivla nachlas Hashem. Why will you swallow up the heritage of Hashem? And perhaps when she uses phrases like that, she represents those who are really from the believers of Israel, and that you're trying to swallow up the Nachla, the heritage of Hashem, she's basically hinting to the fact that she is in line with the divine. And the divine will is that David is king. And that is not, and she's trying to say, although I guess you could make the argument that she was really so pro-David, she could just say the very words, we are David people. On the one hand, she stops short of that, but she may be referencing by saying that she's so aligned religiously. Right now, the will of Hashem is that David be the king, and so she's saying, we recognize David as king. And you're ready to just to kind of take us all out because of Sheva ben Bichri. And you never gave us the chance to talk. You never gave us the chance to surrender. So Pasach Chaf, she was very successful. Vayan Yoav, Yoav answered, Vayomer, and he said, Chalila, Chalila li, im avla, the imashkes. Chalila, far be it, God forbid, right? That, in double language, showing emphasis. Im avla, if I would swallow up the imashkes and I would destroy, that's not the mission here. The mission here is we're not really against your city. The double language of Chalila may be personal and national, or personal and on behalf of David, meaning I'm here as a general myself, but I'm also the general of David. I represent David. That's not David's prerogative, and that's not my prerogative to swallow up a city, to destroy a city. That's not what we're here for. Pasuk Chaf Aleph. Lochein hadavar, this matter is not so. Ki ish me Har Ephraim, there's a man from Har Ephraim, Shivim ben Bichri Shemo, Shivim ben Bichri is his name. Nasa biado bamelech bedavid. He has raised his hand against the king, against David. Tenu oso levado. Give him to us alone. Ve'alcha me'al ha'ir, and I will leave the city. Vatomer Yishal Yoav, she says to him, Hine rosho mushlach elecha barachoma. His head will be thrown to you from on top of the wall. So, first, it's a little confusing when it calls him an Ishmi Har Ephraim, because we've been saying so far that he's a Benjaminite. Mm-hmm. So Har Ephraim, while there probably is an actual place called Har Ephraim, it's also the region. And so the region of Har Ephraim extended a little bit into the territory of Binyamin. And so that's why he's the connection to Har Ephraim. Shivim ben Bichri is his name. We saw that before. He's raised his hand, Bamelech b'David. So I don't know if this is, it's Rashi. Rashi cites a medrash in Koheles, beautiful medrash, where it says that he was attacking the king and attacking David. And both were equally a crime. Meaning, if this was any other king, then he'd be rebelling against a king, and that's a crime. It's Morid b'Malchus. It's a capital offense. And therefore, it's not necessarily that it's David. But on the other hand, it's against David, and this would be a crime, perhaps you would say even punishable severely and hard to say death, but but Chayiv Misa, even if it was just, even if he wasn't a king. The Medrash says even if he wasn't a king, he was such a great Torah scholar. David was such a respected person, and so going against him, even if he wasn't king, would be a crime. And even if it was a king that wasn't David, so it's kind of an episode. So you say, put it together. Now that Shiva Mimichri is rebelling against David, who is the king, it's horrible. So Yoav says, give him to us. Yoav says, give him to us. We should assume that Yoav means alive. Give him to us alive. We'll do with him as we see fit. Now, obviously, we've seen, you know, Yoav doesn't seem to like prisoners. He doesn't seem, if he liked prisoners, then there would be a whole jail full of people that Yoav thinks that should be in prison. Instead, they're in the morgue. But you could make the argument that Shiva ben Bichri is maybe different. Shiva ben Bichri, you can't really call it such a successful rebellion. You can't say that, and he wasn't like a son of Shalom. It was really serious. And the generals, right, you can make the argument, at least Yoav could make the argument about Avner, who was the general of Shaul, and Amasa, who was the general of Shalom, where they were really part of something that was anti-David. Shiva ben Bichri, he led a rebellion for a couple of days. It wasn't so strong. So maybe you could say they would leave him alive, or that they would process him in court, or in the kingly court, in the Beis Din, in the Sanhedrin, something. So Yoav asked for him to be delivered alive.
Where does it say that he asked for him to be alive?
Tenu oso levado. Give him to us alone. It was hard to read into those words. We want you to carry out capital punishment against him and give him back his body. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could read that, but it's not. She answers back, we're going to give you his head.
Right.
Now he doesn't argue. He doesn't argue back. So we're kind of stuck. Did he argue back and it just doesn't tell us? Or
maybe Yoav doesn't care.
Or does Yoav not care? Yoav deems him chayiv misa because he's rebelled against the king. He's deserving of death. So, and maybe you try to say that it doesn't make a difference who carries out the death penalty, even though it's hard to say that because there's even someone who's married b'malchus, it's not fair game. It's not anyone in Klal Yisrael steps up to the plate. There's still a either you take the person to Sanhedrin and there are witnesses and court proceedings and capital punishment, and there was someone who worked, you know, it's not exactly the job you want for your child, but there was a job in Beis Din to carry out physical punishments. There was someone who gave lashes, and there was someone who carried out the capital punishments when they occurred. And presumably, if you went the course of a kingly court where the king is the judge and it doesn't work with the, you know, rules and regulations of Beis Din, again, there has to be some royal executioner, some royal punisher, something of that nature.
So then Yoav was totally for sure wrong, always killing everybody.
Again, Yoav may make the calculation that he's from the royal house. He's the general.
Yeah, but you're saying there's a court system that should have done it.
No? You would imagine so, but maybe Yoav's saying, you know, David's not ready to pull the trigger on this, and I need to do this. I'm acting on the behalf of, you know, I'm acting on behalf of David. Again, Yoav is that complex character. So we don't know if Yoav responded. Maybe he didn't.
No, it's kind of interesting because it's almost like he's up the ante on all this. You know, oh, there's a rebel, he kills him. Another rebel, he decides, he kills him. So then this woman, oh, we'll kill him. He's a rebel. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it just ups how you deal with that.
So here's the age-old question, is this allowed? Is she allowed to give up Shiva ben Bichri? And in the halakhic literature, Shiva ben Bichri gets a lot more space in the halakhic literature than his little rebellion, because he becomes the example in a situation where, unfortunately, and if you read the halachic response to literature, in our exile, there have been many times where Jews are requested by aggressors to give someone up. So let's say, you know, for whatever reason, They want to kill. They're ready to kill a few, but they'll let others survive. Are you allowed to give up one life to save everyone else? So the Talmud Yerushalmi talks about this topic. It's obviously, you know, we have these halachic discussions, and you know, in the Beis Medrash, you have these discussions and you talk about it like you're talking about, you know, milk that fell into the pot. We're talking about human lives, which is, you know, sometimes we're not sensitive enough. So the halacha is that if you surround, if let's say it's always non-Jews who are the aggressors. I guess they could be Jews, but you know, historically we were, you know, at least in Ashkenazic Europe, we were constantly killed. No, they can't really sugarcoat these ones. So they surround the town. They say, "Give us one Jew. We want to kill a Jew. Give us one Jew, a scapegoat, and then the rest of you will be saved." So if they say it like that, "Give us one Jew, or we're going to kill all of you," you're not allowed to select someone. You're not allowed to select someone from the crowd. Why is that person, you know, why is that person's blood redder than your blood?
So during the Holocaust, when they asked the ones in charge of the ghetto, you know, we five Jews, whatever, they weren't allowed to give them up.
Yes, they weren't. If they say it in that language, "We want five Jews,
or else we'll kill everybody,"
or else we'll kill everyone, you're not allowed to, you're not allowed to give it up. And I actually just saw the shul got me into Veterans Day mode. They were successful. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I watched a documentary. I forgot who mentioned it to me, called G.I. Jew, which was on PBS, which is a documentary about the 500,000 American Jewish soldiers that fought in World War II. And so one told a story about his, they were prisoners of war captured by the Nazis close to the end of the war. And it was a large group, about 1,200 soldiers. And the commander was, you know, some guy from, I don't know, I'm making it up, Louisiana, wherever, Missouri, guy, yeah. You know. And the German official said, "Tell me who tomorrow morning, you know, 200, whoever, whichever Jews, they have to be in the front, and the rest of you can go." And he told his entire unit that the next morning they're all showing up on the line. And he said, "We're all Jewish." He's like, "If you're going to kill one of us, you're going
to
kill all of us."
And that was the correct thing to do.
And this was a non-Jew. This was a non-Jew doing it. And he said, he basically said, you know, "The war is coming to an end. And, you know, if you do this, you know, the rest of the army is going to process war crimes." And the Nazi guard walked away. And this guy saved. There were 200 Jews in the group. So the decisions that people made under the stresses of, you know, we're not here. But if you had time to ask the question to the rabbi and sit there with the Shulchan Aruch, then if they say, "Give us a number," without saying any names, so then you're not allowed to hand over. If they say, "Give us Shiva ben Bichri, or we're going to kill all of you," so this story proves that you're allowed to give over the individual. However, there's a debate. The debate, and you know, it's crazy, but there's a debate among the poskim. How like Shiva ben Bichri does the person have to be? What do I mean? Is it that you just have to identify the person's name? So if they say Joe Schmo, Jane Schmain, I don't think anyone's ever said that before. There you go. Said it here first, right? Give us that. Just give us the name. So maybe that's what it was. Or does it have to be someone who's exactly like Shiva ben Bichri in that they are fit for capital punishment? They're deserving of death already. They're almost, halachically, we almost would call them a dead person walking because they're chayiv misa. They were moored by Malchus. So if the non-Jews rounded up the town and said, give us the murderer, you know, the murderer, so then you could give it. So there's a machlokas how to go. Is it exactly like Shiva ben Bichri? Or is it, no, once they assign a person's name and identity, so you can't necessarily say the logic of why is one person's blood redder than the next. They have something, meaning they have an interest in this person more than everyone else. The question is, is that enough? Is that enough or not? Obviously, we don't want to ever have to deal with it, but it was dealt with, unfortunately, throughout the centuries. So she told Yoav that she's going to deliver the goods. She's going to deliver him Shiva ben Bichri. She says we'll kill him. But again, for our purposes, reading in the stories, we have no idea who she is in terms of who she represents. So pasuk habeis vatavoi isha al kol ha'am. She comes back to all of the people of her city, b'chachmasa. She comes back in her wisdom. Now that's a strange word. But it should be vatavoha isha al kol ha'am. She speaks to them. She tells them. She b'chachmasa. She had to convince them. Mefarshim understands maybe perhaps because they were members of the tribe of Binyamin and they're going to be selling out one of their own. She had to convince them. Others explain that she knew they would never buy this plant, and so she came back and she said, "Yoav wants 100 of us to be killed, and then the rest of us will be saved." And the town council's up in armor. No way, we'll never do that. And then she pretends to go back to Yoav, and she comes back and says, "I bargained it down to one. We just have to give up one," so that the town council, the town, felt very victorious. They saved 99 lives, and so they were willing to give up Shiva ben Bichri. B'chach masash, maybe in her wisdom, she was able to convince them this is not going anywhere. Meaning, either he dies and we die, or he dies and we don't. Meaning, he's dying anyway. I mean, she explained the whole logic that's what Yoav is going after. And so,
does she explain the Gemara?
Perhaps that kind of logic, meaning this is our way. Right, they're asking for someone particularly that, and he maybe she was able to say that person is Moed B'Malchus, and she may be extending it. If we don't give him up, then we will all have the status of Moed B'Malchus. Right. It could be many people in the town weren't aware what was going on, and because they never were given the opportunity. As she said, they were never given the opportunity to negotiate in good faith and surrender. So this is their time to have a say, right. And so she's giving them. But
it doesn't explain why she had him killed. She could have just given him over.
Oh, so
well, maybe he wouldn't just.
So Pasa continues.
He stood there while they chopped off his head. I mean, no.
Well, because there's a concern. If he's alive, so as he's going down, he can pull others with him. He can start perhaps pointing out people of the city who are his co-conspirators. So maybe there's a concern of that. So maybe that's why they want to kill him.
Wait, so just where did they come up with the story of 100 citizens? Where's that from? Like, what words make them think that?
B'chach masa, she had to try to use some type of wisdom. So what wisdom would she use to her? To her townspeople. So that's one of the explanations, that she was using her wisdom. She kind of, I mean,
it seems far-fetched because she could have used the wisdom from the beginning, like what she said to Yoav. You're going to wipe out, you know, kill the whole city.
And now she has to convince the townspeople to give up one
so
of their own.
Why can't she just say, if we don't give him up, he's going to kill all of us?
Yeah, so that could be.
Where do they get so involved with 100?
Meaning, because how are you going?
What word?
How are you going?
Is there a gematria for 100?
Oh, I don't know about that. I don't know about that.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, but me, it's some way of, I think it's some way of seeing her. The word seems to be strange, so it's some way, right, of using the word.
Oh, so they
just, okay. I hear you. Because it's not describing her. It doesn't say vatavo ha'isha ha'chachama.
Right.
It's saying the way she came to the people. and if I think the story is more, again, this is it's a terrible story because it's about rebellion. It's about death. But just looking at her, if she was not a representative of the city, the story, and or at least her role in the story, is even more impressive. That here is someone who was came out of left field,
right,
and was able to with her intellect, you know, basically play with a general in David's army who she totally is in control. She becomes in control of, and her entire town that she convinces to work the way that she thinks is the best. It in order, I mean, maybe you would say selfishly, she saves her own life, but she also saves the entire city.
Yeah.
Which is what happens.
He came to the city. He's alone. He's running away. Shiva ben Bichri.
He came
alone. He's got followers, but he really doesn't have any followers because nobody's with him. So did he go to the town because he thought they would follow him and support him? And
I imagine he thought they would, since the town had a wall, the town was somewhat protected, that he could buy time to maybe get some reinforcement. Meaning he could, now it's obviously, it's hard to lead a rebellion from behind the...
Right. I mean, he's trying to lead a rebellion. I mean, again, he's trying to lead a rebellion. You have to kind of squash the rebellion, but it doesn't seem like he really has. He's got a following, but he really doesn't have a following.
Right. I mean, listen,
he's alone at this point.
He's not going to get a good grade on this rebellion. Right. I mean, Avshalom had a pretty good rebellion.
Right.
He was planned out with years of propaganda, of planting seeds, of. Yeah. So the pasuk continues. Pasuk Chaf Beis. Vayicher su es rosh Shiva ben Bichri. They cut off the head of Shiva ben Bichri. Vayashlichu el Yoav. They threw it down to Yoav. Vayiska b'shofar. He blew the shofar. The same way he blew the shofar to mark the end of the rebellion with Avshalom. He blows the shofar again. Vayifutzu me'al ha'ir ish lo halav. So they vayafutzu Mitzvah Simon says in Yan Pizur to scatter. So they scattered, disbanded the army from being against the city. Ish lo halav. Every man returned. All the soldiers returned home. The Yoav Shalom Shav Yerushalayim. Yoav returned to Yerushalayim El Hamelech, to the king. Another possibility that they might have been concerned if they give Shiva ben Bichri back, so the mode how he would be killed would be up to Yoav. And if this is one of their own, maybe they wanted him to be killed in a more humane way. But I mean, I don't know, because it happens to be that Yoav seems to kill people very quickly. He knows, like, whatever this fifth rib,
yeah.
You know, that seems to be the way to go. You know, so, and again, there's no, so it's just a possibility. But it accomplished, in the end, it's, you know, from the Isha's perspective, it's mission accomplished. From Yoav's perspective, it's mission accomplished. And, you know, whether or not Shiva ben Bichri would have been taken as some prisoner of war and kept alive, would he have been taken as a prisoner of war and be killed in a more organized official capacity? So that we don't get to know. The last few psukim in Perek Chaf seem a little bit unnecessary. We had previously seen a list of the officers of David, and here in these few psukim we hear like it's like David's cabinet, and we're hearing it mentioned again. Perhaps because the coming to the end of the rebellion of Shiva ben Bichri is really the official end to the rebellion of Avshalom. And kind of now David has consolidated power again. So we hear about who his officials were. It might be to highlight, the whole list might be to highlight Yoav, that Yoav is back in power. Because as Pasuk Chaf Gimel begins, V'Yoav Elkoa Tzava B'Yisrael. Yoav was in charge of the entire army. That even though David had tried to get rid of him and place Amasa, well, now Yoav killed Amasa. But Yoav just publicly stopped another rebellion. Yoav is very popular with the men. He's popular with the country. And so David feels like he has to have him. We keep mentioning the fact that it's only in the lifetime of Shlomo, when Shlomo becomes king, and David's giving him his last words of advice and requests, that David asked Shlomo to deal with Yoav. It was something that David felt he couldn't, and he reinstalled Yoav as the head of the army. It was either that David realized that he needed Yoav, he could not deal with Yoav, but Yoav is there nonetheless. So Yoav's in charge. Al kol tzva b'Yisrael, Benaya ben Yoyada, al hakresi v'al haplesi. He was in charge of the archers and the slingers. Those are sound like divisions within the army. We saw the Kresi and Plesi sometimes refers to the Sanhedrin. It may be referencing more of a spiritual leadership. Benaya ben Yoyada, also called Benayahu, he's going to end up playing a major role in the lifetime of Shlomo. Va'adiram al-Hamas. Adiram was in charge of taxes. This was a position that was not mentioned earlier, and it could be that it was only at a later stage in David's reign as king that he installed taxes to the extent that he needed a cabinet position to be in charge of the taxes. Yehoshaphat ben Achilud Hamaskir. Yehoshaphat was the Maskir, is the chronicler. What do you have?
Recorder.
The recorder.
Like the secretary.
Yeah, the royal secretary to write down everything that happens. You know, so it shall be written, so it shall be done. Someone had to do the writing. Ushava sofer. You know, so what's the difference between the maskir and the sofer? The sofer is the scribe. Do we know what they
scribe?
Different royal positions. V'tzaduk v'avyasar kohanim. You know, at this stage, there are two kohanim. Tzaduk, Avyasar had been the Kohen Gadol, and he's in a little bit in limbo now. We saw that David had at one point requested of the Urim V'tumim, and while, in order to ask the Urim V'tumim, you need a Kohen Gadol, and the Urim V'tumim would not respond to Avyasar, but it did respond to Tzaduk. And this was going back to the time of Eli, that when Eli was punished from being in the position of Kohen Gadol, it wouldn't happen for generations, but it was going, the position of Kohuna Gadola was going to leave his family. That Aaron had four sons, Nadav and Avihu died, unfortunately, the day that the Mishkan was established. So it left two sons, Elazar and Isamar. Elazar, as we read him in Sefer Bamidbar, becomes the Kohen Gadol with the passing of Aaron. And then Elazar's son Pinchas becomes Kohen Gadol after his father. In Sefer Yehoshua, we see that at the end of Yehoshua. Pinchas was the Kohen Gadol throughout most of the time period of the Shoftim. And it's understood that Pinchas, who was the Kohen Gadol during the horrific episode of the Pilagesh Begiva story, which ended in a civil war against the tribe of Binyamin. So Kohen, who's in this position of peace and supposed to be bringing peace, it kind of happened under the watch of Pinchas. And so Pinchas's line, which was really the line of Elazar, son of Aaron, lost the position of Kohen Gadol, and it shifted to the family of Isamar, which is where Eli came from. It was Eli's actions and the sons of Eli's actions that led to it going, reverting back to the line of Pinchas, the line of Elazar, and that eventually in the time of Shlomo becomes Tzadok. But right now there are really two Kohanim, and remember those were the two Kohanim that David had placed in Yerushalayim, where they were supposed to pretend that they were on the side of Avshalom, and they were the key in the spy network that David created. They played the key role. They sent their sons to go and tell David. They're the Kohanim. And then we're told, kind of a little bit strange, Vigam Ira Hayairi, that's his name, Ira. It's a bad, I don't know how they have it in yours. In the art scroll, they have Ira as I-R-A.
Ira, yeah.
Right, which we pronounce as Ira. Because that's an English name, Ira. But it's really Eret. So I guess, I don't know. Should be Eret. I don't know. I don't know how you'd spell it better. But Ira Hayairi, Haya Kohen lo David. He was a Kohen for David. And what that means is, it's strange, because if you try doing the process, to be called a Yairi, so you could come from the famous family of Yair. The most famous Yair was from the tribe of Manasseh. So if you're from the tribe of Manasseh, you could be, but then you're probably not a Kohen LeDavid, because a Kohen is usually, as the Pasuk just said, Kohanim or Kohanim. So you're forced into saying one of two things. Either he was a Kohen, and the reason why he's called a Yairi, maybe there was another relative or another, somehow he got the name Yairi, but he's really a Kohen. What does it mean that he's a Kohen for David? So the Chazal understand the connection between this Pasuk and the next story. The story in Pasuk Chaf Aleph is going to take us to a time, as we'll mention in a few minutes, really an undetermined time. We're going to have like three different opinions in terms of when the story of Pasuk Perek Chaf Aleph takes place, which is an intense famine that takes place during the reign of David. So what's the possible connection between a famine and this Kohen? So if you understand him being a Kohen LeDavid, the Gemara says, the Gemara teaches it sounds like not such a crime, and it sounds like the punishment is more severe than the crime. But you know, we are not the ones who are supposed to understand how punishments work. It's a Gemara in Maseches Eruvin. The Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Zavda, Kol Hanosein Matnosav LeKohen Echad. Anyone who gives all of their donations to a single Kohen, maybe Ra'av LeOlam brings famine to the world. How does he prove that? He says, because the Pasuk says, Ira Hayairi Hayakohen LeDavid, as we just read, that he was a Kohen to David. So the Gemara says, LeDavid, he was only a Kohen to David, but to the rest of the world he wasn't. Rather, we're supposed to read it that he was David's personal Kohen. Anytime that David gave gifts to the Kohen, he only gave it to one Kohen, and therefore, and the next Pasuk reads, and then there was a famine. So that the understanding is that part of the punishment for famine is that you... Sorry, part of the punishment for giving all of your matnas kahuna to one Kohen is bringing famine. That the rationale behind that is that a Kohen did not, the Kohanim and the Levium did not receive portions in the land. If they don't receive a portion of the land, how are they supposed to survive? So Kohanim, more so, right, when it comes to the Truma, which is what we separate from crops, so Kohanim get a relatively small percentage. They only get 2%. As opposed to the Meiser Rishon, which is what's given to a Levi, which is 10%. After you take off the 2%, 10% of whatever's left goes to the Levi. But a Kohen has many, many gifts. There are Chafdala, there are 24 Matnos Kahuna. Every time an animal was shechted, any type of animal, any time you made a barbecue, and you didn't go to the butcher to buy the meat, but you, old-fashioned way, you shechted an animal, there was part of the animal that had to go to the Kohen, some of the best part, the tongue, the whole... There's a whole thing that had to go to the Kohen. Every time you make bread, it goes to the, right? You know, we can't give it to a Kohen anymore. But it used to be, you would, right? Your hand, it's, I don't know, it's about the size, it's close to the size of a, whatever, your piece of dough, my piece of dough, that could make something. It's an interesting pull-apart challah because it's everyone's dough tastes a little bit, you know, you put eggs in, you put sugar in, you put, you know, by Parshas Noach, we have people that put, they put food coloring in to make a rainbow. Like challah is a rainbow. Yeah. So again, what was the quality of a Kohen's dough? Okay, you can, but there were so many, every time you shear sheep, it's gracious hagez, the first bit of wool goes to the Kohen. So if you give all of your matnas kahuna to one Kohen, you are not spreading this, you know, kind of, the Kohanim were in charge of spirituality for the people. So it's kind of like the Torah created a welfare system where we take care of our spiritual leaders. The Kohanim worked in the Beis HaMikdash. They were also supposed to be the teachers of Israel. So we have this system, but if you mess with the system, then you're causing famine to Kohanim, and so the punishment back to you is famine in response. I think humbly it sounds a little severe to say that there's going to be, you know, because David chose one Kohen to give all of his stuff to. Now there's going to be a famine for the entire country. So maybe you have to say, well, you know, what is the impact of David's actions? Meaning when some simple citizen decides to only give to one, I even remember growing up, you know, in class, we always had a, you know, there were some Kohanim in the class. Usually kids know, I don't know, whatever grade, they know their Kohen. And some, you know, if the Rebbe's giving an example of something, so he'll use, you know, I had a kid, Ari, he was a Kohen. So, you know, so we would talk about, oh, you're going to give it to Ari. It's almost like, you know, you almost sense that if the Beis HaMikdash comes, we're going to give things all to one Kohen. You know, we'd give not all to one Kohen, but he was the example. So if one individual does it, it's hard to say, but that there'd be a famine. Here we're talking about David. David's the king. And the example that the king sets for the country is going to make its mark. So if David's only giving to one Kohen, now someone might be skeptical. How would people know that David's only giving to one Kohen? Okay, you can play this.
Well, the Kohanim would know, right? Not the Kohanim.
Again, you just know that you didn't get. You don't know for sure, you know.
It seems that whatever.
Well, don't you think David, he had a lot? Like, it's not like, wouldn't he have a lot of stuff?
Right.
He has big meals.
Right.
I mean, family. It's not like you're just bringing him one like grocery bag. You know? Like,
right. No, listen, the Matnus, right. It's a good account to have. Right. You know.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
You know? It seems that whatever David does wrong, the punishment is very severe. It's not. I mean, because he's the king, but it just seems that whenever he makes an error,
mistakes are much higher.
Yeah.
Like what else?
Well, his baby died because he slept with.
Yeah, but that was a big mistake.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, but for the baby to die, I mean, there's consequences to everybody else. It's not just her. I know, but it's not just him that's affected. Like everyone.
Because of what he represents.
Right. So that the fact that there's a Rav in the whole.
Right.
You know, here, that's not so strange based on everything else.
Because I also think these actions could have caused a lot of unrest between the Kohanim. It could have caused a lot of problems.
Definitely.
You know what I mean, if one guy's, you know, getting tons of great food, assumed David.
Right. There's a system in play. Right. And when the system works in harmony, it's a great system.
Right.
When there's a breakdown in the system, so then the whole system is
could fall.
And society is challenged.
Right. So to me, he makes a lot the of other mistakes
just in terms of the other way to read the pasuk is that the term Kohen can sometimes refer to just like someone who's prominent. Meaning, it doesn't, the fact that they're singling out a Kohen, it may just mean that he would have some type of the way Rashi quotes too. He quotes this Gemara in Erevin, and then Rashi says Upshuto shel Mikra. So sar v'shofet, he was made into some type of office or some type of judge. It's not a common term, but it is also used. The term Kohen sometimes is used in Tanakh to talk about someone prominent. So here we're giving this list, right? Because we listed his official Kohanim are the Kohanim Gedolim, which we listed in previously. Ira may have just been an officer. So God willing, not so exciting, but next time we'll deal with this actual famine and what happens from there.
Who wrote this book again?